Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Liz Oles will be talking with Matthew Fitzsimmons, the author of Constance. A breakthrough in human cloning becomes one woman's waking nightmare in a mind-bending thriller by the Wall Street Journal bestselling author of the Gibson Vaughn series.
And I'm Liz Oles. Also, later in the show, Josh talks with researcher and journalist Jess McHugh about her book, Americanon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. The true, fascinating, and remarkable history of 13 books that defined a nation. All this and more, so stay tuned for Right on Radio. Hello, Matthew, are you there?
I am here, Liz. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're talking with Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of Constance. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book?
Constance is I suppose you'd call it a science fiction blended mystery thriller about a young woman who, the book is set in 2040, so about 20 years from now, and it conjectures that human cloning has become commercially available, and that in the event of a client's untimely death, that their stored consciousness would be downloaded into a cloned body so that their lives could essentially continue with as little interruption as possible. And the book is about one such client who wakes to find out that the original Con Darcy, that's the name of the main character, has died mysteriously, and she is thrust into the role of detective. It's essentially a book about a woman who's both the detective and the victim of the same crime.
Fascinating, fascinating. I really enjoyed the book. I kind of, at the last minute, asked him to do a reading. Were you able to get a reading together for me, Matthew?
I do. It is right in front of me.
All right, great. Why don't you go for it?
All right, so this is actually, I'm going to start from chapter 4, which is essentially the moment she wakes up. This is describing the moment that the main character wakes up as a clone for the first time. As Khan clawed her way up the gray tunnel towards awareness, she knew something was very wrong. The hangover effect after refreshing her upload was rarely pleasant, but it had never been this bad before, not even close. Her head felt waterlogged, and a steady pressure was building against her temples. Drip, drip, drip. Her brain felt as if it had been crammed into a soggy matchbox. No, not her brain, her mind, and it wanted out. Bad. She yawned uncontrollably. That much was normal. Even though her refresh bore a superficial resemblance to slow-wave sleep, it wasn't restful. It explained that during orientation. How suppressing the prefrontal cortex simulated sleep while the rest of the brain lit up like a slot machine hitting a $1 million jackpot, which is why it felt less like waking up and more like a guided tour of the world's largest tequila distillery. When she opened her eyes, her eyelashes were crusted shut as though she'd been crying. It happened. Paleogenesis called it autonomic emotional response, a side effect of the intense stimulation on the hippocampus. Khan just called it draining. Though the lights were dim, their glare cut into her retinas like rescue flares. She raised her hand to shield her eyes, but her arm did not respond. She couldn't even feel it, as if nothing at all existed below her shoulder. She tried to lift her head to confirm that she still had arms, but her neck wouldn't obey either. A terrible thought occurred to her. It had been a malfunction. They'd fried her somehow. She squeezed her eyes shut and tried to remain calm. Paleogenesis billed uploads as routine outpatient procedures. Sure, there'd been mistakes in the early days that had left smoking vegetables in the chair, cut and paste instead of copy and paste, but Paleogenesis claimed it resolved those issues, and that the latest generation had upload errors of less than 0.00004536%. Khan memorized that number because there was comfort in its infinitesimal smallness. There was a better chance of a shark attack on a mountaintop than of a neural lobotomy during a refresh. Or so Paleogenesis assured its clients. The sound of voices encouraged her to reopen her eyes. A man and a woman came gradually into focus. Khan didn't recognize either of them, but more ominously, neither was Lelia Skari, her steward. Worse still, both wore white lab coats over hospital scrubs. No one dressed like a doctor at Paleogenesis, ever. It was part of their shtick to distract clients from thinking about where they were. That alone frightened Khan more than how bad she felt. She opened her mouth to ask what had gone wrong, but all that came out was a low, grinding moan. Oh, wonderful. The lab techs glanced briefly at her, then returned to their LFDs. Khan decided to give establishing first contact one more shot. "Where is Dr. Quao?" she croaked. Not pretty, but progress. The female tech looked at her partner questioningly. He explained, Quao used to work here. He left before you hired on. The female tech made an alarmed face. How far back does this one go? 18 months, he said. No, the female tech said. That's not possible. That's what her timestamp says. Well, that's insane. Who authorized this? The process is automated, he reminded her. Yeah, but there are safety checks in place. Well, someone screwed up, he agreed. Royally. Khan hated being talked about like she wasn't there. Hello, she said. Hello. The two techs fell silent. Would one of you explain what the hell is going on? What did you do? Why can't... She stuttered over the next word like a hiccup. Move. Where's Dr. Quao? They'd said he left the company, but she must have misunderstood. The male tech glanced at his partner before answering. Dr. Quao doesn't work here anymore. What are you talking about? Saw him this morning. Where is he? He took a job in California. In the last 6 hours? Her voice growing stronger by the word. Maybe she wasn't completely screwed. 9 months ago, the lab tech said, almost apologetically. The hairs on Khan's shoulder stood up. Ironically, the first sensation she'd felt below the neck since waking. They really had fried her. That was the only explanation.
And
she looked around, taking in her...
I was going to say, why don't we stop it there. That was about 5 minutes, so I don't mean to stop you in the middle, but that was perfect. Absolutely perfect.
All right.
So I have some questions about cloning first, because that is a major, obviously, part of the book. Can you give us a little bit of the history of cloning?
Within the book or within the real world? Which are we?
Both. But within the real world first.
Well, within the real world, obviously cloning has come along leaps and bounds over the last few decades. Famously, Barbara Streisand cloned her dogs. We've cloned sheep. We can clone most anything we want to. And the interesting thing that I realized is that we do human cloning in America almost every day in the form of research in terms of stem cells. We clone human cells all the time, which is why there are no federal laws governing cloning. It's a state's issue. What we don't do, obviously, is make a person, but the capacity to do it certainly exists. It just is an ethical divide that thus far we've been unwilling to cross. And the book, sort of takes that next step. I basically write a scientist character who jump starts both. It learns how to combine consciousness mapping, which is something that is being worked on currently, with human cloning to create this service that would allow a person's consciousness to be uploaded and stored digitally, and then conceivably be downloaded into a clone of themselves later on. That is not obviously possible now, but the interesting part of the research was that it is something that I think could conceivably be possible, not within the 20-year frame of the book, but within the next 40 or 50 years at the rate the research is going, possibly.
Wow. I was going to ask how viable it would be for humans, and it sounds like it's, well, not right around the corner, but within some people's lifetimes.
Possibly. I'm making some big leaps with the idea, with the notion of being able to download a consciousness into a body. I talked to some neuropsychologists at Johns Hopkins, the interesting thing that the problem gets into where the mind actually resides. I mean, traditionally we think of the mind as residing in the head. But the more and more we study the body, and the central nervous system is a huge part of what the human consciousness is. There are studies now that say that memory and mind health are very much linked to your gut. The expression gut instinct is more on the nose than people would have thought. Good gut health leads to better memory.
I'm curious, since we're talking in this realm, about the ethics. You really cover in the book a wide range of ethical ideas from parangenesis to the children of Adam. And I don't need to know your personal, but how did you come up with all these different ideas for different ethical positions on cloning?
Well, what was interesting to me, and what's always been interesting to me, is the idea that, that science will make these leaps, and we will often introduce technologies without necessarily thinking through the ramifications. We sort of play catch up. A new technology gets introduced into a society, and then that society has to sometimes discovers down the road what the drawbacks are. So with cloning, it was a fascinating intellectual experiment if someone introduced human cloning and it became readily available, what would the legal ramifications be? When someone dies, a death certificate is issued, their social security number is suspended, and there are steps that are taken that when a life ends. So how would personhood be transferred from the person to their clone. If that person was married, would the person who was married to that person is now a clone, would they still be married? Are you legally required to be married to the clone of your dead spouse? Mm. And sort of thinking through how the culture would have to, and the legal system would have to catch up with a technology that they that they hadn't really, you know, that the writers of laws had never dreamed of being a problem. And I think we see things like that now playing out with various technologies that are disrupting how things used to be done, and that the inventors of the technology aren't necessarily thinking through or really concerned with what effects is this going to have.
I'm thinking of a particular situation where some will situations come up, and money is, I mean, it's hard enough end of life stuff with finances without all these complications, and it gets pretty complicated there in that particular situation.
Absolutely. And particularly if it's not federally governed, then you get into a situation where different states have different standards.
Right.
And which we've had in this country before, where one state has sort of a set of standards for how something is handled, and others, written into the Constitution is the idea that states must respect other states' laws. And you can get into very sort of complex push-pull about whose laws take precedent, and that's how you eventually wind up at the Supreme Court. So it was just a really fascinating hypothetical, once the world building got done, to sort of play in the sandbox I'd created.
It is a fascinating book and very enjoyable in that regard. We're
speaking
with Matthew Fitzsimmons, author of Constance, a book about a person who is a clone and all the difficulties that happen to her while she's going through that. Now, in the thing for the book, it says that one person is looking for the murderer of herself, and I'm wondering how you came up with that amazing idea.
Well, that was actually what started the whole book off. I was noodling around one night, and I was trying to think of a way to just take a traditional detective story and twist it in a way that I hadn't seen before, come up with something fresh. And I remember just thinking to myself, well, it would be really cool if someone had to investigate their own murder, which obviously isn't possible, because if you're dead, you can investigate your murder unless you are Patrick Swayze in Ghost, or that, you know, or, I mean, there are stories that have sort of a supernatural twist where you can finagle that scenario. But I wanted it to be a real flesh and blood person investigating their own flesh and blood murder. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out a way to make it happen until the word clone, what if it was a clone? And there was one of those sort of like nice eureka moments, and I just started outlining. And so it really just came from a very sort of basic impetus of, how could I write a story where the detective and the victim were the same person? And out of that came Constance. Thanks to the miracle of cloning.
Yes. And, I mean, had you studied cloning before? Had you done some research, or this just popped into your head, as you said, as a eureka moment?
No, it was just a eureka moment. I knew next to nothing about it other than, having seen movies, read books, and reading the newspaper. So it really was now I need to educate myself on this subject so I can think through how I want to portray this, how to ground the world of the book so it feels plausible, that it feel that while a number of things in it aren't obviously are a conjectural, how to make those conjectures seem grounded in a plausible world. So the research was just a lot of fun. I mean, it's a great fun part of being an author is you get to read a lot and you get to talk to smart people. And it's amazing how generous people are with their time. If you say, hey, can I buy you a drink or dinner? And so I can pick your brain on your area of expertise, people, because I want to write a thriller about it. People are remarkably generous with their time. So I've been very fortunate to talk to some very smart people who helped make me sound reasonably smart.
Would you call it, it's funny because you talked about the spirituality, and this book is science fiction in my mind, but it's also very, very believable in terms of a real world. I wasn't going, oh my God, this is Robert Heinlein. I was just really drawn in and believing in these people and the things they were going through. How did you manage to make that happen?
At the end of the day, I think a good story is about the characters, regardless of, if you go to see Star Wars, for example, you're held there because you like Han Solo. I would argue that the best part of almost any story are the characters. It's not, even the biggest, glitziest blockbuster movie, at the end of the day, you're there because the characters, you care about them. And if you lose sight of that, it doesn't matter what your special effects budget is. It doesn't matter any of the rest of it. If you don't have characters, you don't have anything. So it has been called a science fiction novel, but to me, it's just a story about this woman, about Con Darcy and her life before and her life after, and her trying to reconcile what she understands about herself. And that has almost nothing to do with the cloning part of it. And so my hope is, I think what any author hopes is that they've created a real and grounded and believable human character at the center of it, even if outlandish and impossible things are happening or to them and around them.
Talk a little bit more about your research. And in addition to taking people out for drinks, I'm wondering if you I'm wondering if you had a library that you went to, or a librarian, or a mentor that you worked with. What kinds of things did you do to stir the pot in your mind of how this worked out for you?
Well, my library was mostly a bookstore, and once I'd sort of assembled. People who were, once I had bought drinks for the group of people who were willing to help me, I had a constitutional law professor. I had a neuropsychiatrist from Hopkins. I had an engineer from Bell Labs in Fort Worth. Once I sort of had like my team, if you want to call them that, I don't know that they would appreciate being called my team. But once I had the people who I felt I could rely on and who were willing to lend me their time, you start picking their brains. What books should I read? What periodicals would be helpful here? And they were, so I think I had multiple mentors to borrow your phrase. One reading leads to another, and you just sort of start to, it's a little bit like being in college where you're writing a book report when you're in high school. It's just you go down the rabbit hole and you see where it takes you. And sometimes you come to dead ends, and sometimes you come to unbelievably rich veins of information that helped to make the world of the book you're trying to create grounded and believable.
Do you do a writer's group, or are you on your own?
I have multiple, particularly during the pandemic. I think a lot of authors, we're a fairly solitary bunch. They really only let us out for conventions a couple of times a year, and otherwise we're in our caves and under a rock working away. And I think there was a lot of bonding together. I have two or three different sort of semi-regular Zoom calls with authors who were very, you know, who, you know, you could talk through ideas, you could pitch things to, who would read bits and pieces if you needed them to. So, you know, it's really valuable to have a support group, particularly right now, I found.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here. I'm wondering if you want to compare. You have a series of thrillers, which I can't wait to get into now that I've read Constance. How do you compare? Are you going to keep doing the more science fiction-y kind of thing? Are you going to keep with your thrillers, or what's going to happen next?
I don't know the answer to that. That's a very good question. I am currently writing a second book in the Constance universe, if you want to call it that. It's a sequel of sorts and a companion. I realized at some point that I had more to say in this world, and I'm very excited about the second book for it. Whether I will keep going, you know, it's interesting as an author that once you sort of get a label assigned to you, you write romance novels, you write, publishing is very big on its labels, mm-hmm. thrillers, mystery writer, romance novel, fantasy author, science fiction author. Once you are sort of have that label, you're to an extent sort of expected not to, wander too far afield. It will be interesting to see what the mechanics of publishing sort of expect coming for. I mean, I think in my mind's eye, I think the dream would be, this is going to be a ridiculous thing to say, but someone who is in a wonderful position is a man like Stephen King. Now, obviously, because he's the biggest author on the planet, that's a silly thing to say. But what I mean by it is that that people just read. You know, Stephen King has written horror novels. He's written an entire fantasy series. He's written some science fiction novels. He's written some straight, just dramatic novels. And people just read Stephen King books. And I think I think the dream would be to be in a position like that, where, you know, whatever idea came into my hot little head, I would be able to write. I mean, that's obviously, something of a pipe dream. That's a difficult position to attain, but I think that would be the dream, would just to be the freedom to not necessarily have to write one type of book or another. Because I think the Gibson Vaughn series and Constance, at the end of the day, are both just thrillers and mysteries, and one has a science fiction component to it. But I would argue it's still just at the heart of it, all books are just, are just books. So that's I think you just caught me pleading my case to my publisher to let me do whatever I wanted. So thank you for letting me practice my spiel.
You won me over.
Good, that's one. I got to work on everyone else.
You got to be careful with series, though. I think of Sue Grafton and how many years she did those series, and then she never got to Z.
No, I know. I think writing a series that Gibson Vaughn series was five books long, and I loved writing it. But I do think you're right that you can become. And I'm not saying this is Sue Grafton, but I think I would have a hard time writing. You know, the longer you write a series, in a strange way, the narrower your options become, mm-hmm. because the weight of the series dictates what kind of story you can tell. Like I've had plenty of ideas for books that just can't be a Gibson Vaughn book because of what has come before and who that character is. And so while it's nice to have a series into the familiarity of those characters, it can also become a limiting I needed to come up with a story specifically for that series, not just what's the best story I can come up with.
Right.
So, getting to write Constance was tremendously freeing and exciting because it was not to sound painterly, but it was a whole new canvas.
Mm.
And it's really hard to describe how exciting that is to have a totally blank slate on which to come up with something new. So, I think you're right. Series is wonderful, but they have their dangers.
They have their dangers, yes. Well, how can people find you on the web? What's your website, and do you have an email address and all that?
I surely do. The easiest way to find me is at my website, www.matthewfitzsimmons.com. From there, there are links to my Twitter account, my Instagram, my author email, and really, if you just go there, all of that information is listed there, and I would hope to see people there.
And Matthew Fitzsimmons, just so people know, has a Z and an S in the spelling. So,
yes, very Irish. Fitzsimmons.
Fitzsimmons. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation tonight. And
I did
enjoyed
too.
The
thank
book.
You.
I really enjoyed the book. This has been Matthew Fitzsimmons talking about his book, Constance, which is a fascinating look at cloning and many, many other things. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
You bet. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Today, I'm talking with Jess McHugh, author of American Canon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Guardian, among many other publications. She has reported stories from four continents on a range of cultural and historical topics, from present-day Liverpool punks to the history of 1960s activists in Greenwich Village. Welcome to Right on Radio, Jess.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
So I like you start off the book, you're skeptical of nostalgia in many ways, and I am as well. And you talk about the background of the word nostalgia. It comes from two Latin words, nostos, meaning coming home, and algos, meaning pain. And I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of knowing this vis-a-vis American Canon.
Yes. So when I wrote the book, American Canon, I really wanted to kind of grapple with both the kind of the things that we can be proud of in our nation's history and maybe the things that we need to re-examine. And so, I say in the introduction that the book is not a takedown of our culture, but at the same time, I think like many Americans who are awake and alive to this moment in time, it really means grappling with that. And so I liked this idea that we can have a homecoming that, might involve some pain, but still is about returning to where we're from.
In the Old Farmer's Almanac, it still has appeal to not so much for its utility, but the comfort of nostalgia. It's a rural simplicity in a world facing rapid change that only grows exponentially. But you talk about in the book, though, too, this is in many ways a myth. Not that it's false, but it profoundly influences many Americans today and how they perceive reality. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that point a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So I talk often in the book about myth and mythology, and I use it in the kind of Greek sense, which is to say maybe a story that gets at a deeper truth or gets at some kind of belief that we hold in ourselves. And so when I talk about the kind of farmer mythology, I mean that, yes, of course, there were farmers and there are many people did farm to some extent. But I think we like to hold on to this idea because we like to kind of imagine the roots of America America as quite simple, of just these people cultivating the land. And what I found interesting in the research with this one in particular is it was almost preemptively nostalgic. By the time, you know, even Robert B. Thomas, who was the founding editor, comes out with his almanac, there are already mills replacing the farmland where he grew up. And so I think it speaks to how much things change and how we look to the past for comfort when things are chaotic.
And the myth, too, you talk about in the book is it's mostly male-centric and almost exclusively white. When that's not necessarily the case, though, right?
In terms of the writers?
In terms of Old Farmer's Almanac, I guess, or the idea of this yeoman farmer was almost always a white man. I mean, you talk about
yes.
like one point by, oh, I forget the figure, it's like 12 million acres at one point is owned by African-American farmers.
Yes, that was the, I think that comes from Du Bois in the beginning of the 20th century. Yes, that's what I find interesting is that when you see kind of depictions of the small farmer, it's always, you know, kind of the white man with his cow or a horse or what have you. And that was what was interesting in speaking to culinary historians about the range of people who were farmers. I mean, not even to speak of the many farms that were tilled by slaves, but also in New England, where I'm from, there were plenty of free Black folks, especially going into the 20th century, for whom farming was their life. And I think that often gets forgotten when we talk about our history.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a history with the Merriam-Webster Dictionary that I was not aware of. Noah Webster was one of America's first nationalists and wanted to instill a uniformity within our country through language, even at the expense of regional differences. What makes it especially interesting is the Webster Dictionary's resistance to Trump's administration. You talked about the tweets that the Webster Dictionary put out during his presidency. At times, though, the book, though, in its history, is at odds with its original intentions.
Yes, that was something that was the first book that brought me into what will become American, and was this story of the dictionary, because, you know, like many journalists, I spend too much time on Twitter, and I noticed that Merriam-Webster had this really sassy kind of taking aim at Trump, but also Hillary Clinton, in terms of their use of language. And it surprised me to learn that, you know, the founding author of the dictionary was this nativist, was this, you know, nationalist who wanted America to be this world power. It's hard to talk about comparisons in some sense, because 18th century nationalism is not what nationalism means now. But I would be curious what Webster would have to say about Merriam-Webster's current incarnation, which I deeply enjoy.
As do I. There's a part of your book for Noah Webster that I'm based on my own experiences within a public education system, I think still seems very true today. A lot of American children, I think, are more familiar with the whole short history of America than they do of perhaps the Roman Empire. Is it too far to say that the American public education system is largely envisioned by, or was first envisioned by, Noah Webster?
I think he's certainly one of the earliest thinkers in America thinking about public education. He's certainly not the only one, but I would agree with you that he's hugely influential. I mean, his book, his Speller, before the dictionary, sells something like 100 million copies. And you really do see this ethos that he wanted of every school child should be more familiar with our short history. And he was speaking in the 1780s than they should with the Roman Empire. And to a certain extent, that is definitely still true, speaking from my public school education as well.
Right. And it's shocking too that you said the dictionary solidified the relationship that between Christianity and the American language as well.
Yes, that was interesting. You know, he refers to himself as a born-again Christian, which was the truth for many people in the 19th century with the Second Great Awakening. He has this moment where he's writing the dictionary and he says God comes down and speaks to him. And he goes on these wildly kind of unscholarly searches for an original language. But especially when you look at the 1828 dictionary, all of the definitions are imbued with God, whether it's the definition for love, which he somehow relates back to the book of Genesis. And what was interesting to me is when I interviewed Peter Sokolowski, who is one of the editors of the dictionary now, he said that is one of the books that Christian homeschoolers continually ask him if they will reprint because they want to use it to educate their children now.
That's funny. That's really unique. Speaking of unique, the autobiography of Ben Franklin was, you quote Carla Mulford in saying that he had a power in serving both American nativists and recent immigrants alike as a mystical civic person where different people could identify themselves in Ben Franklin. I was wondering if you talk about what do you think was the secret behind Franklin's success in people gravitating towards him and seeing themselves in him, in his work, without a biography?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it is his power as kind of a PR man. One of his lesser known skills, because he's such a well-accepted brand to us that we don't see kind of all that he did behind the scenes to make it that way. And I think the autobiography is a great example of that. People relate to him because he was so many things. He was this great performer. He was this chameleon. And so throughout his life, he was a scientist and a diplomat and a scholar and a businessman. And I think because he comes from the bottom and works his way up, people on both ends of the spectrum choose something to believe in Franklin.
Mm-hmm. You have an interesting insight I noted from about in your book, but I mean, it's about self-help books in general that I liked. I'm going to quote it here. It's in some ways the most American genre of literature since it connects personal achievement with the good of the group while situating both the problem and solution within the individual itself. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yes, thank you. This was something that came out of researching and speaking to some academics who study self-help. And it is that, because I think one of the things that self-help does that really comes out in the American story is this idea that if you fail or if you succeed, you deserve it. And I think in some ways, self-help does embody that, because it says, you know, we don't really have a strong social safety net. If you're going to succeed or you're going to fail, maybe you have the help of some close friends or your community or these books that you can buy for an affordable price. And I think that is both motivating and a little bit frightening.
Mm-hmm. Before reading this, I was not familiar with Catherine Beecher, and I was wondering if you could talk about her personality and what led her to write A Treatise on Domestic Economy. And her solution for women in her time was to elevate the status of domestic life as a profession.
Yes. Yeah. So she is a fascinating woman, and even her sister, you know, the famous Harriet Beecher Stowe, said something to the effect of, "I found her strange, nervous, visionary, and to a certain extent unstable." Mm-hmm. And I think that about sums it up. But she has this idea, which is in some ways, I think, kind of empowering for its time and a little bit radical, the idea that, okay, maybe women in the 1840s are not going to enter men's professions, but we can make the home a profession. And her idea, she was thinking that people could have doctorates of home economics. You know, the term didn't yet exist, but I think the term would not have existed if not for Catherine Beecher arguing that this was a real, not just an art, but a science to keep a home.
I want to ask you now about Emily Post and her work. She was a former socialite who turned understanding the upper class trappings into a guide for etiquette. But not just, I think she hit a nerve, though, on the culture of her day, stressing about the value of table manners. And I was wondering if you could discuss about how her book offered social clarity in a time when maybe that was not really transparent, perhaps.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, the book comes out in 1922, which is kind of the midst of the Roaring Twenties. And I think in some ways people thought, oh, manners are going out the window. And I think that was partially some of her motivation in writing the book. But, you know, for instance, F. Scott Fitzgerald was a huge fan of the book, and he said it would be fascinating to write a play of manners based on this. And I think that speaks to some of its power. I kind of see like a great Gatsby figure reading etiquette and saying, okay, you know, it might take some work, but if I memorize 400 rules about where to put forks, I can convince people that I'm of their same status. And to a certain extent, I think that's how people were using it, or we're trying to use it. We don't think of etiquette as a social tool, but I think people really did use it as a way to become upwardly socially mobile. And that's why it was both a bestseller and one of the most frequently stolen books at libraries.
And you talked about the book, you contacted the great-great-grandchildren of Emily Post, which I loved. It was one of my favorite parts of the book, actually. I was wondering if you discussed how, despite the background of Emily Post, they're very laid back. I think you said that, I'm kind of blanking on the name for daughter or great granddaughter, but she did pot every day, and she was just really cool. She was late when you first got to meet her. So you could talk about that.
Yeah, they were amazing. They were so fun. You know, it's funny you say that. This is one of my favorite chapters to write, and that was one of my favorite days of the research. They were late, and she shows up with this rescue dog that she just got, and she's got her hair up in a clip. And yeah, she smoked pot every day for this book that she wrote about cannabis etiquette. And I'm in with my pressed slacks and my shirt and thinking like, wow, this is not what I was expecting. But it's really refreshing the way that they've kind of continued with the brand. And she said, you know, we still are interested in tradition and putting people at ease, which in some ways was Emily Post's first goal. But, you know, as she said, if something's no longer useful to us, we got to move on.
Moving on. speaking of Dale Carnegie, the author of How to Win Friends, Influence People, I would think we a person who radiated just incredible charisma and confidence with a book with that title, but I was shocked to discover he was horribly self-conscious and had severe anxiety worrying what others thought of him. For a person that was dubbed the father of self-help movement, I thought that was interesting.
Yes, it really endeared me to him because I had always sort of associated his book with CEOs and MBAs and people who were kind of smooth talkers. And I was surprised to learn that, yeah, he had this really brutal life, brutal upbringing. He grew up kind of dirt poor at the turn of the 20th century. And he remembers, you know, having to burn their hogs who died of cholera every year and, you know, being in debt. And then he in a very, what I found to be a very Dolly Parton kind of moment, he's commuting to college on horseback because his parents can't afford the $1 a year room and board. And so it was fascinating to me that he realizes that kind of the antidote to shame is charm and is self-confidence. And if you get other people talking about themselves, they're not going to notice what you're wearing. They're not going to notice if your clothes are patched. And I thought there was something really kind of poignant and graceful in that.
And you just touched on this, but a lesson from Carnegie's life that's absent from How to Win Friends and Influence People was his persistence and willingness to succeed.
Yes, I think, and I wish he had made that more explicit in his book, but so much of what made him a success was his willingness to fail. He, you know, he was a traveling salesman, he sold bacon and lard, and he sold cars, and he lived in his cockroach-infested apartment. And I think that is part of the American story that we don't tell quite as often, but is important, is that a lot of the times what comes before success is failure after failure after failure, and just this willingness to get up and try again.
Totally. And I want to move on quickly. There's a lot of material in this book, so I try to touch as much of these works as I could. Betty Crocker's Picture Cookbook, there was a twisted, bizarre reason behind the success you talk about. It raised the stakes of, I think, domestic life for a lot of women, and that there's a binary outcome where if you can only... You had to either make a good meal or a bad meal, and it meant the difference between having a violent husband or a happy husband.
Yeah, that one was a little brutal because there are parts of Betty Crocker that I find interesting and sometimes even weirdly empowering, but that was a tough one. The first broadcast of Betty Crocker, she says something to the effect of, you know, if you fill a man's stomach with soggy boiled potatoes and cabbage, is it any wonder that he goes out and gets in a fight? Like, we should be happy if he's just mad at us. I think it does speak to the extent to which homemaking was, you know, raised to greater heights, and you see it become even more of an imperative when women are dealing with strained budgets during the Depression, and then when the home front war effort becomes a question of life or death. And so the homemaking in the mid-century really shifts in terms of its power.
There's a line you quote from Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask that I thought was ridiculous, and I wanted to ask you about
it. That book has a lot of ridiculous stuff in it.
Oh, well, this one kind of took the cake for me. Dr. Rubin really, he says this in the book, and I want to clarify, he wanted guys readers with their sexual organs into the space age, to a place where orgasms were plentiful and Coca-Cola was the best vaginal douche. Is that really what he talks about in the book? I mean, you say this in the book, and I was like, I got to ask you about this.
It is what he talks about in the book. And I feel, as a public service announcement, I should say that Coca-Cola as a vaginal douche can kill you, as I read about in my research. But yeah, it is just a note to listeners. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think it speaks to just how much people's understanding of human sexuality has changed even since the 60s and the 70s. You know, he was a psychiatrist, and so many of his views were kind of Victorian and Freudian in their attitudes towards sex and not very scientific, as we see.
Yeah, I mean, this is just published, though, what, 1971?
69. But it became a huge bestseller in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah. It's not that long ago, really.
No, really not.
My last question for you is, you draw an interesting parallel between New Age philosophy and Donald Trump. You talk a little bit about how Norman Vincent Peale was Trump's childhood pastor.
Yes.
And it left an indelible impact on him on having relentless positivity and unflinching self-confidence, even at times in the face of contrary evidence. How do you think this embodied the character of Trump?
Yes, in some ways I was surprised, but in some ways it made a lot of sense to me, because when you look at Norman Vincent Peale, who's famous for positive thinking, a lot of the idea is that it doesn't matter what's happening around you. All that matters is your belief in yourself, and eventually you will attract good things to you. And so in a certain sense, people become kind of moot. No amount of outside input can change that if that's your foundational belief. And so I think it goes a long way in explaining Trump's character and this kind of unflinching belief in himself that can at times be hard to fathom.
Right. That is the end of our interview. I've been talking with Jess McHugh, the author of American Canon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 bestselling books. Jess, it's been great talking with you. This was a wonderful read.
Thanks so much. I had a lot of fun.
And now this. Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Matthew Fitzsimmons and Jess McHugh, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible.
You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/program/Right on Radio, plus listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.